14.5% of Australians smoke cigarettes. This is down from 22.4% in the year 2001. The rates are pretty similar in the United States, but much higher across Europe, with an average closer to 30%. Now, there's pretty much nothing we can do for a smoking patient that would improve their health as much as getting them to quit smoking would. So how do we do it? Firstly, are you more likely to quit successfully if you do it cold turkey? Or is it better to stop gradually? Secondly, what's the evidence for medications used to help people quit smoking? This week, we look at a randomized control trial that compared gradual smoking cessation to abrupt cessation. We'll then examine the evidence for the different treatments used to help people quit. Hello and welcome to episode 16 of the Evidence-Based Medicine Podcast, where each week we delve into the evidence to see how it can improve our practice. I'm Daniel Aronov, and today, what's the best way to quit smoking? Gradual or cold turkey? And how much do drugs like Champix, bupropion, and nicotine replacement therapy help? Firstly, where in the world did the term cold turkey come from? It's almost universally used, where it means to stop an addiction suddenly. So I did some research. According to the online etymology dictionary, it came from the fact that cold turkey is a dish that doesn't require any preparation. So quitting cold turkey is quitting suddenly, like without any preparation. But then I looked at dictionary.com, and it reports that the origin comes from a phrase used in America in the 1950s, to talk turkey, which means to speak bluntly about something in particular. So maybe quitting cold turkey is to quit bluntly. If only there was a peer-reviewed journal of etymology. So look, I think we're all sold on the benefits of quitting smoking. But I just want to mention one particular trial on smoking cessation that is one of my favorites. It was published in Chest in 2007. Chest, the medical journal, not the adult magazine. Ba-dum-tsh. Actually, I think I can get a real one. And the brilliance of this trial was that they were assessing the outcomes of a smoking cessation intervention, not whether they actually quit or not. What I mean is that normally studies will tell us, say, cardiovascular disease reduction in a group of people who quit smoking versus those who continued smoking. But this study just assessed the cardiovascular outcomes from whether you gave an intervention to help people stop smoking or whether you didn't, regardless of how many people actually quit in each group. So they recruited 209 smokers who had just been admitted to hospital for either a heart attack or heart failure. Everyone got about half an hour of counseling about the harms of smoking and how to quit, and they were given all this written information while they were still in hospital. Then they were randomized into two groups, an intensive treatment group who got a further 12 weeks of counseling plus nicotine replacement therapy or bupropion to help them quit. And the second group was a usual care group who didn't get any further intervention outside of that 30-minute counseling session that they got in hospital. At the end of 2 years, the mortality rate was 12% in the usual care group, and in the intensive smoking cessation group, it was only 2.8%. So like a 10% absolute reduction in all-cause mortality after 2 years. That's unheard of any other intervention. I mean, let's compare that to aspirin. There's not a doctor in the world who wouldn't give aspirin after a heart attack. And, you know, unless, of course, they couldn't take it for whatever reason. But giving aspirin for 2 years after a heart attack leads to a 1.4% reduction in mortality. So this 10% is huge. And what's encouraging to me is that the rates of smoking cessation at 2 years were not fantastic, 9% in the usual care group and 33% in the intensive treatment group. So it's nice to know that even if the majority of patients are not quitting despite your constant nagging, overall, it's still providing a very impressive benefit. Okay, so the main study I wanted to talk about today, which triggered this entire episode, was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in May 2016. They wanted to see whether gradual smoking cessation was better than cold turkey, or maybe worse. They took 697 adult smokers who were smoking at least 15 cigarettes per day and were addicted. They made sure they were addicted by conducting a survey called the Fagerstrom Test for Nicotine Dependence, or the FTND, which asks things like, how soon after waking do you have your first cigarette? Do you find it hard to refrain from smoking in places it's forbidden, like a library or a church? And do you smoke even if you're so sick that you're stuck in bed the whole day? It's a score out of 10 where they consider a score above 5 to be moderately dependent. So they randomized them into two groups. All the participants in both groups were told to set a quit date for 2 weeks' time. The cold turkey group were told to smoke as normal and not reduce the number of cigarettes they smoked until that quit date. The gradual cessation group were told to aim to halve the number of cigarettes they smoked in the first week, then halve them again in the second week, and then quit after that second week. After the quit date, both groups got a daily 21 milligram nicotine patch, plus a short-acting nicotine replacement therapy of their choice. Things like nasal spray, mouth spray, nicotine gum, lozenges, inhalers, or sublingual tablets. They followed them up for 6 months, and the primary outcome was how many were abstinent from cigarettes by 4 weeks. They confirmed abstinence by using a tool called the Russell Standard, and this allows for a 2 week grace period from the quit date, and also uses exhaled carbon monoxide concentrations to confirm abstinence. They also did this at 8 weeks and 6 months. So, the average age of the patient was 49, half of them were men, and they were smoking an average of 20 cigarettes per day. Their average addiction score, that FTND score, was 6, indicating that they were moderately addicted, and 94% of them were white. So, what were the results? Well, at 4 weeks, abstinence was achieved in 39% of those in the gradual cessation group, but in the cold turkey group, this increased to 49%. So a 10% absolute increase in smoking cessation rates, making a number needed to treat of 10 in favor of cold turkey quitting. By 6 months, as you'd expect with these things, the rates of abstinence were much lower, but they were still better for the cold turkey quitters. They were 15.5% in the gradual cessation group versus 22% in the cold turkey group, making a number needed to treat of 16. Now, what I found really interesting is that they actually asked all the patients at the start of the study whether they would prefer gradual or sudden smoking cessation. Now, of those who preferred gradual, they were still more likely to quit when they stopped abruptly compared to if they stopped gradually. So I thought that was pretty interesting. The bottom line is that for heavy smokers who have moderate dependence, a method of abrupt or cold turkey smoking cessation is superior to gradual smoking cessation, with an absolute increase in abstinence of 10% at 4 weeks. So that's actually all I wanted to talk about for this episode, but given that we're only 8 minutes in, it's probably a good time to talk about the evidence for pharmacological management of smoking cessation. For the sake of completeness, to make this episode the one-stop shop for all evidence on smoking cessation. So, there are 4 agents that have good evidence to improve smoking cessation rates in smokers who are willing to quit. They are nicotine replacement therapy, things like patches and gum and those sorts of things, nortriptyline, bupropion, and varenicline, which is Champix or Chantix, depending on where you're from. Now, I just want to mention that the Australian College of General Practitioner Guidelines recommend nicotine replacement therapy, varenicline, and bupropion as first line, but they don't recommend nortriptyline as first line, saying nortriptyline should only be considered as a second line agent due to its adverse effects profile. So just be aware of that. But I mean, I don't know. I think they all have adverse effects, and sometimes in certain patients, the adverse effects of nortriptyline might be favorable, but you make up your own mind. So, let's start with nicotine replacement therapy. There's been a Cochrane review on this. In fact, there's actually been a Cochrane review for each of these 4 medications. Firstly, what would you predict the actual quit rate is for someone who is motivated to quit? So they're in the action phase of that Prochaska De Clementi cycle of change. It's around 10%. That was consistent among all the placebo arms in all of these trials. Just shows how addictive these things are. And it reminds me of that Mark Twain quote, "Giving up smoking is easy. I've done it hundreds of times." All right, enough of that thing. So, back to this nicotine replacement therapy versus placebo Cochrane review. So, 10% in the no intervention group were able to achieve abstinence. And this went up to 16% in the nicotine replacement group. And it didn't seem to matter which nicotine replacement therapy you used, whether it was gum, patches, inhalers, sprays, or lozenges. Now, they had some really great analyses in this review, so I'll quickly just share some of the highlights. Firstly, in studies that compared short duration of nicotine replacement therapy versus longer duration, there was no difference in abstinent rates. The authors of the Cochrane Review recommended 8 weeks or less. Secondly, using a combination of a long-acting nicotine replacement therapy, like a patch, together with a short-acting NRT, like gum or spray or inhalers, to control those sudden cravings, seemed to be better than either one alone. It was about 15% abstinence with just a long-acting or a short-acting versus 20% when using a combination of both. Third thing is there was a slight benefit to starting the nicotine replacement therapy before the actual quit date rather than starting after. And lastly, in terms of harms, they seem to be local reactions like skin irritation from the patch, hiccups and sore throat in the mouth spray, and bad taste with the gum. They couldn't find any increase in cardiovascular disease, though they did find an increase in palpitations or chest pain, which occurred in 1.4% of the placebo group versus 2.6% in the nicotine replacement therapy group. So about a 1% absolute increase in these side effects. All right, so now let's take a look at bupropion. I really struggle to say this word. I don't know why. So with bupropion, the abstinent rates in the placebo group, according to this Cochrane review, was around the 10% mark. It was actually 11.5%. And with bupropion, it went up to 18.7%. So very similar to nicotine replacement therapy. In fact, there were a handful of trials that directly compared bupropion to nicotine replacement therapy, and there was no difference in the effectiveness. Now, the main side effects with bupropion are insomnia, because this is more of a stimulating antidepressant. Insomnia occurred in about 25% of those taking bupropion compared to 15% in placebo. Also, about a 10% increase in dry mouth as well as nausea. Most alarmingly is it does increase seizures, though this is very rare, thankfully, in the order of 1 in 1,000, but obviously wouldn't want to give it to anyone with epilepsy. Okay, let's do nortriptyline next. So this drug is not approved for smoking cessation in Australia, but seems to be as good as the others. Granted, it has only been studied in 2,500 patients compared to, say, bupropion, which has been studied in like 12,000 patients. But I still think the evidence is very good, and it's like infinitely cheaper than all the other options. So again, this Cochrane review found a 10% abstinent rate for placebo, and for those who took nortriptyline, it went up to 20%. In the trials that compared it to nicotine replacement therapy, it was maybe slightly better, but not statistically significant. And in terms of side effects, they are mainly the anticholinergic side effects like sedation, dry mouth, constipation, difficulty urinating, and blurred vision. The biggest fear with tricyclic antidepressants, though, is that they're often fatal in overdose, so you'd need to be pretty confident the patient doesn't have any risk of suicidality. But yeah, not sure that's reason to exclude them as a first-line agent for smoking cessation. Perhaps the side effects are desirable in a specific patient. If your patient had anxiety, a bit of insomnia, and also wanted to quit smoking, you could potentially hit all three of these with nortriptyline. A triple whammy. All right, last drug on the list for smoking cessation is varenicline, or Champix. It's the newest on the block. A Cochrane review has found 27 randomized controlled trials, making up around 12,500 patients. The quitters who used placebo had an 11% chance of remaining abstinence, again, similar to that 10%. But in the varenicline, or the Champix group, this went up to 25%. There have also been studies comparing varenicline to some of the other smoking cessation medications, 8 trials comparing it to nicotine replacement therapy. For nicotine replacement therapy, abstinence was achieved in 19% versus 23.7% with varenicline. So the chance of successfully quitting was 4% higher with varenicline over nicotine replacement therapy. 5 trials compared varenicline to bupropion, finding varenicline to be superior by about 6.5%. It was 17% versus 24%. So seems to be slightly better than the other agents, but potentially offset by the far greater cost of this medication compared to the other three. Now, in terms of adverse effects, the major concern about this drug has always been about neuropsychiatric problems, things like depression, suicide, strange behaviors, anger, and things like that. In fact, in 2009, the FDA put a black box warning on Champix with regards to all of these problems. But in 2015, a large meta-analysis specifically looking at these side effects was published in the BMJ, and with 39 randomized controlled trials, were not able to find any difference in depression, any difference in suicidal ideation or attempted suicide, any difference in aggressive behaviors or irritability. And since then, there's also been a really large and a really well-done trial with 8,000 patients, of which 4,000 had an actual psychiatric disorder. And the main aim of this study was to see if it caused any of these neuropsychiatric problems. It was called the Eagle Study, and they also couldn't find any increase in psychiatric issues with varenicline, which I find really fascinating because I certainly hear reports from patients about being crazy on that drug. Perhaps it's just the withdrawal from the nicotine, or maybe it's just an idiosyncratic reaction. What's your experience? Anyway, so the definite harms were nausea, occurring in about 25% of people, and that was the most common side effect, abnormal dreams, which occurred in about 12%, and higher fatigue and insomnia as well. So there you have it. Let's bottom line everything we've talked about so far. So, cold turkey seems to be a better way to quit, achieving a 10% increase in abstinence rates at 4 weeks over gradual cessation. The chance of achieving abstinence in a motivated person without any help is about 10%, sadly. And this can be doubled with either nicotine replacement therapy, bupropion, nortriptyline, or varenicline. Varenicline, or Champix, seems to be superior to the other medications, achieving a 4-6% improvement in abstinence over nicotine replacement therapy and bupropion. Okay, thanks for listening. The show notes and references can be found on the website, www.ebmpodcast.com. Please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and check out my evidence-based videos on YouTube by searching Dr. Dan in YouTube. Next week, we're going to cover the evidence for using honey to treat cough. There's been 3 randomized controlled trials now, 2 of them comparing it to other treatments for cough, and you might actually be surprised by the evidence. That's next week. I'm Daniel Aronoff. I'll talk to you then.